David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 434. I'm your host, Steve Raker, toiling away in the comic book bunker, like Reed in his lab while Sue waits patiently to go out to dinner. With me, as has been for many years now, our matchstick WWX Kevin from the Great White North, and Andrew the LA Rabbit, burrowing between the fault lines that network across the left coast with his thing ring doing his thing.
Woohoo!
I just got back from Golden Orange Comics, Steve.
Nice. Marvel Noise is a semi-monthly podcast and sponsored by nobody. Our tenuous ties to the internet and masses are courtesy of the mighty Deliberate Noise Network, damaged but still fighting the good fight, and now featuring Geek Brunch Noise, if I'm not mistaken.
We need to get
I think they amalgamated. Kind of a DC thing when you think about it. They had all these different worlds, and now it's been all unified.
We need Ghost Rider 2099 to straighten this all out for us.
And of course, and Indie Comic Book Noise is on the Deliberate Noise Network also, which is our sister show where we talk about the indie books that we're reading.
Always with more episodes than we publish.
And our response to recent site and tech problems is such that the links on the site to shows before 2019, I believe, are currently inactive. They're in the Disney vault for safekeeping for the meantime. But let us know if there's an episode you're looking for, and you know, we'll hook you up, like True Believer listener Johnny Betts did, who's rereading the Bronze Age Power Man series and wanted to re-listen to those old episodes when we were covering it. All right. This episode is our second foray into the Peter David written Captain Marvel series that began in the fall of 1999. We did the first 13 issues, plus the zero issue, Kevin, a few episodes ago on Marvel Noise, episode 430. And this episode, we're covering issues 14 to 25 that were on the stands from December 2000 to November 2001.
That's a wild era.
I got these on my tablet currently, which I recommend via the Marvel app. I've been singing the praises of some of the newer comics. Really do look, especially with all the sparkly star stuff and galaxies, everything always looks good on these things.
Yeah, just watch out for that issue 14 if you're on the desktop. I mean, I read it, then I went to go check it out again. It wasn't there, and now it's back again. I don't know. There must have been some weird Psycho Man playing with the inner space there where the issue disappeared for a while.
Anything's possible with the Marvel Unlimited digital service, but... These issues are supposed to all be there. They were for me.
They were for me, too. Maybe the Canadian one was.
And our characters in this series are Agnes Vell, the cloned son of Captain Mar-Vell, and Rick Jones, who he is bonded to, similar to how his dad was bonded to Rick back in the day, and they switch back in and out from what they learned in our last segment is the Microverse. And Rick's former wife, back from the dead, running a comic shop, Marlo.
And her ghost.
Her ghost, Lorraine, right, who's haunting her constantly editorializing. And Moondragon has entered the cast as a regular. So issue 14 is a fill-in, but it's more than a typical fill-in because guest writer Fabian Nicieza, the Fabster.
That guy again.
He revisits in flashback the events of his 1996 Captain Marvel series with penciler Ed Benez that was canceled after six issues. And they don't just flash back to what happened in that series, but also what would have happened had the series not have been canceled. But it's presented here in flashback as if it did happen. So then those things are added to Genus's history between that point and this point, which is kind of a fun way to retcon that material in and also tie up the loose ends that were left dangling from that series.
Also not the first time that we got another story where we're like, is that a real story? Oh, they're adding another story in this book.
I liked having, for me, Patrick Zercher made the, or Zercher, not sure how, if it's a CH sound or a CK, but he helped speed this along. Because it was somewhat interesting, but it's pretty word heavy. I'm sure this did well on the stopwatch test, Kevin.
Yeah, it's a 12-issue series in one issue, right? And under a nice Andy Kubert cover, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's sometimes what people look for. Like, that's their number one requirement.
Patrick Zercher? I don't blame him.
That, too. I mean, we know him from Thunderbolts, so.
Writer Peter David and penciler Christopher Williams, a.k.a. Chris Cross, return with a bunch of inkers for a two-part arc in 15 and 16 that revisits the Microverse, where Drax is a pawn of the Psycho Man who wants him to bust open this cocoon.
That makes me think of many things when you have cocoons.
For sure. And any Starlin characters, right?
Exactly.
And inside the cocoon,
it almost looks like you're like, well, is Darkseid going to show up? And you're like,
manipulates Drax into busting it open, and inside is Fred, Genus Vell's evil twin clone from a future alternate dimension with two D's in his name. That's what makes him evil.
Naturally.
And a pretty spacey looking design. I think the art really works better in the Microverse when it's kind of crazy. I mean, it's not bad in the real world, but I like the exaggerations that exist, because the Microverse is kind of a crazy place. I mean, Psycho Man's a great design and with all the funky piping and everything all over the place. So
for sure,
I think it really lends it to that, as opposed to when we're intercutting back in the real world. I don't know. It's not that there's a problem with it. I just like all the craziness more than kind of the sterile kind of straight lines and all that stuff. There's no, none of that wavy craziness I think I lean more towards.
Hey, you had me at Microverse, Andrew.
Oh, I thought Andrew was going to mention that he liked when Wonder Woman showed up.
The future Fantastic Four and Avengers had managed to trap Fred into this cocoon, but now Psycho Man has let him out, and he's no friend to anybody. He wants to conquer the outer worlds and captures Genus to test this rebigifier ray, which Genus, I think, cleverly sees as a possible chance to split him and Rick up from their being bonded situation, because, you know, if he returns from the Microverse and Rick is already back on Earth, then you know, maybe they've broken the chain.
Maybe. Or they could just die horribly.
Oh, yeah. The representation of them merging together looks great. They use it for the cover and in the yes. book. It just, I really like that. I could do more of that.
Not Chris Cross's strong suit is composing covers. They're pretty crazy.
I mean, you've said that previously. I like him drawing his expressions and his characters, like, overacting and all that. Not so much the covers.
Yeah. It's like you go for like extreme close up on a cover. It's like that's unusual. But instead of splitting Rick and Genus Vell up, instead it turns Genus into pure energy, where he then enters the components of the ship and ultimately blows the ship up and ends the threat of Fred. 2 Ds.
Forever.
We also get Drax fighting the Micronauts. And one of my favorite bits here, Andrew, really reminds me of my childhood, because we get to see Commander Rand sporting his original space glider jetpack and wings. And the figure that they turned into Commander Rand was originally the space glider figure.
Yeah, little did they know, all they needed to do was take all the magnetic parts off of Baron Garza and he would have fallen apart. But a super clever toy design. For those of you unfamiliar, they were a magnet, so you could take arms and legs and rearrange it. And that was the Baron Garza guy from the toy in Japan that became added to the Mego Micronauts line over here.
They were great when we had my house fire when I was in fifth grade in 1980. I lost all my toys, my Micronauts and everything, and the ones that were burned, like the metal pieces remained, you know, so like I could identify like vehicles and figures by like what pieces remained, and like, what, you know, there would also be partial melts, right? So like half the vehicle or dude would be melted and some of his metal would be like sticking out and remaining, like a Croyer's last stand and all that.
When the first wave G.I. Joes with those were really crummy plastic, so a lot of broken thumbs and things like that, I would sometimes melt a little bit and then take red paint and paint them. So they were the ones that, like, their hands got blown up or whatever. So, because, yeah, like the toys a lot, but, man, those are very the first wave before they added the extra articulation and everything is a pretty junky plastic, in my opinion.
These two issues, issue 15 also opens with 4 pages of the girls, Marlo and Moondragon, arguing with Genus about whether or not he should go to Hala and save Unarog from being psychically altered, which is according to the Kree culture, because she can, like, disintegrate people with her feminine pheromones. And with this sequence, Unarog's plight kind of becomes the bookends of this whole batch of issues that we're covering. There's also a bit where a red winged commando type is turned into a bird by a wizard, then hit by a truck, found by Marlo, who then takes him in to nurse him back to health. She'll all come back yeah, into play.
Yeah, I like all these weird subplots. Like, you're like, what's that about? And then you, like, you go to the comic shop, and then you're like, what's that about? And you're like, oh, some bits about the industry. And then you go to the Microverse, and you have so many different spinning plates.
And David's such a good writer that he can keep you entertained with each of them as you return to them. And he kind of really paces things well as far as when he chooses to deliver story beats with each one. He's a great comic writer. Great for especially this late 80s into the 90s and 2000s period. Good stuff.
I agree with you on the pacing. The over-reliance on very specific pop culture got a little... I'm kind of so... I don't mind it one, but it felt like a bunch of movies where they'll just quote the lines and things like that, which is fine, I guess, but I would have liked less of that, I think. and more sort of being situational, but it's always fun. He takes a few shots at sort of people with difficult names to pronounce. And the, like I said, there's the Golden Apple comic shop here, which clearly her shop is mimicked. And I those parts are good, but I don't know. For me, it's a little bit, I guess it just kind of links it to a time and a place. But I can see how in 2000, this is super fresh to get like something about Mary references in your comic book.
I mean, I feel like I have the eternal struggle with that type of thing. Like, if you're writing comics for the moment for people to enjoy, or you're writing comics for the future, and then there's the thing like, well, you can write your comic generic, so then like nothing ever stands out, but then nothing ever stands out. So
right. Yeah.
This is kind of weird. You gotta find a proper balance.
Yeah, I just like to go very gentle on that stuff and also I feel like it's a little bit of riding that other thing's coattails more. Like the humor is from the reference, is from the humor from the original thing.
Yeah.
And it's the joking on the joke. But I will say, man, this art team mimics Jim Starlin really well starting with 17, Steve. When I pulled that one up, I was like, holy cow, I don't mean to be litigious or anything, but that looks an awful lot like Jim Starlin.
Issues 17 and 18 are a real treat because it's a two-parter involving Thanos and Thor.
Featuring Jim Starlin again?
The original Gemini team. Not just Starlin, but also inker Al Milgram.
So, yeah, I really enjoy it. Like, and what a change of pace from our... I mean, they're both fun, but they're very...
I know.
Kevin, this must have been fun when you were buying them off the rack. See, like, goes from one extreme to this other one.
I mean, it is, because I don't know. I guess, like, I wouldn't say, I'm trying to place it exactly. Because I was really into Criss Cross, but then it's also, and you could say, oh, he was the new up-and-comer, but he wasn't like, but not really, and not really super popular. And then you go to Jim Starlin and it's like, oh, it's super classic, but also, I mean, I guess he still has some of that like Infinity buzz about he's coming on a book, but I don't know by this point if
it legitimized the use of Thanos. This was Jim coming back for what, the third time to Marvel. But Marlowe gets approached by some like goth looking Billy Butcher guy named Walker, and Ghost Lorraine warns her to like get away, like he's got death all over him. Then Thanos shows up and the two fight. Genus intervenes and finds himself fighting alongside the Mad Titan Thanos against Walker. And then Thor joins in to help too. This is a visual comic book smorgasbord here.
It's just weird to see Thor fighting Thanos in here, because like that Thor issue 25 where it was like, oh, this is their first big battle. It's like it wasn't that long ago.
Well, it also must have been hard for you, Kevin, because Thor has just regular muscles. He doesn't have 90s style like muscles upon muscles. He looks like someone might actually be able to achieve the physique that he has. So that part was just a fun...
He's just regular Thor.
Yeah, he's not 90s Thor, you know.
Classic Thor. Well, does anyone... I mean, he should be wearing, like, what, half the clothes if he's, like, 90s Thor?
It turns out that Thanos' love, Death, had a fling with this Walker, Death God, then dismissed him, and now he wants revenge. And Death hid her persona inside a dead soul that was resurrected. Wink, wink, Marlowe. And that was back in Incredible Hulk 399 and 400. A crazy lady who thought she was Rick's biological mother stabbed Marlowe dead. And then a grief-stricken Rick sought out help from the leader, whose crystal machine revived her in issue 400. It was all written by Peter David, so he's playing with his own canon here. And I liked tying it in with the explanation of how the leader's machine only worked because Death needed to escape and hide. And, you know, Marlowe coming back in a, how should we say, a delayed cognitive state for a few issues was because of the merging of Death to her and her body and mind, you know, dealing with that and resolving that. And also that's why this Lorraine ghost was drawn to her, because she's got some of Death in her. And this whole thing was made all that much cooler because, you know, Starlin's drawing Thanos too, standing there.
I like the pulling in of Thanos, like, oh, I knew this was a problem. This guy, he draws on all the dead people of his dimension, so I had to study Magog for a while. Like, it just, it did make it seem like a smarter kind of back to the planning, scheming Thanos who's got it all. And that part, I had a good time enjoying the whole, where does it come from? And this Walker dude spaceship is a great design. Like, I'm picturing, sure, there's a whole bunch of vans with this painted on the side of it. It's a, like a ship that looks like a giant skeleton with a skull as the main bit in the front, and little skulls along the side. Just looks pretty killer.
And it's massive. It dwarfs Thanos' ship, you know. Really, really cool. And so Walker tortures Rick Jones by lopping off one of his arms and then aging him and making him all old, grizzled and everything, like me and Andrew. And that flushes Death out of Marlowe, but she's pissed. And Thanos knows it, right? He's like, oh, you've done it now, right? Death kills Walker, and then in a nicely executed scene, pun intended, Death proves Rick wrong by restoring Marlowe once Death released her from their being bound. And there's also a cool payoff involved to an opening scene from the issue 17 with Thor and a crew of Vikings that worshipped him back in the past that then plays a role in Walker's defeat in this issue. It's cool. It's a really, I thought it was a good two-parter to use as a vehicle for these two creators, Peter David and Starlin, to work together, and Starlin to return to Thanos and start his process of retconning everyone else's use of the character besides him.
Yeah, that's a particular obsession.
I thought it was not just fun, but I like the two issue thing. Like, there's a lot of story, it goes a lot of places, we get some resolution, it fits in with the over, you know, we get some working about things that happened before leading to some things that are going to happen in the future. So I thought all in all, what a nice little, you know, still compressed, but still a ton of story going.
And the two covers make Cross's, you know, weaknesses stand out as far as cover composition. They're just nice, solid comic covers.
19's great. It's like a close up of their two faces as they're about to kiss or fight or one of the two.
Yeah, it's funny. 19 and 20, I'm like, these are pretty good.
Issue 19 has Crisscross back on pencils. Thanos and Thor try to restore Rick from being an old man and only having one arm, but they have no luck. And Genus has a walkabout vision quest in the dream world and faces Star Fox and the Magus.
I like going backwards in time. See, I don't always object to that time messing around. I thought this worked well. Although, can't say, sorry, gentlemen, I know this is your Star Fox, but not really mine.
Yeah. Well,
I'm glad they said his name.
they keep on dealing with that Avengers Forever stuff, too, because if I remember, fans kept on asking about that stuff.
Yeah. So shout out to Songbird.
Yeah, exactly. So they're like, well, unless we get to that future or deal with that stuff, like the title or the writer is like never going to be free of that material. So rather than wait 10 years, I'm like, well, Maybe we want to do some of that stuff now.
And Rick and Genus face off in the dream world and have a big have at it, and then meeting of the minds. They get everything pretty much squared away.
A little short Magus. I was like, I think it's because I like purple, but he was always a fun character.
And well, either, you know, someone's a villain if they're wearing purple.
It's either in 19 or 20 also that Rick disappears momentarily and says, oh, I just was pulled into a thing with Kang and the Avengers and everything. Now, I haven't read Avengers Forever, but did Rick appear there old with one arm and a beard?
No, Rick was
young and in a wheelchair. Rick.
Yeah, he had that whole weird wheelchair thing, and then it was like a whole Supreme Intelligence type of what's that power that he got?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was that whole business, and there's just so much to that story, and then like you have all the, I mean, I guess there's a bit of a crisis thing, world's getting wiped out, and then you have like a continuity cleanup going on in the background too. I mean, there's a lot going on.
Something tells me that he appeared that way somewhere, though. That it just seemed, I don't know, but
yeah.
Who knows?
I mean, that's kind of part of the bit.
Issue 20 and 21 show Rick not adjusting well, and also kind of seeming depressed. Like he's not seeking out help from Mr. Fantastic or the Tony Starks that he knows. He's pushing Marlowe away in the process, to the point where she feels kind of on an island and almost wishes that Ghost Lorraine was back so she had someone to talk to.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, I would have preferred he suffered in more silence. He really, and I know they try and disarm it by having people call out how whiny he is, but that doesn't have, like, reading a bunch of these issues where you're like, oh man, Rick, just belt up, buddy. Like, you were such a complainer. It really got to be hard when I was reading these, and I'm like, yeah, this is not as much fun as the other one. Also, the other weird thing that you guys know is my strange pet peeve is when they, the images of like the comics on the back or posters or things, like I like them to be less prominent, but that's my own thing. I mean,
but how did they, did we ever figure out how they put those back there? Like, is he still drawing those?
I don't think so. Cause they look like they look like the covers. I mean, maybe he's just really good at mimicking the arts on those. I assume they just had little tiny images of them and plucked them in. I don't know. I should have looked up the original artwork. I wonder what these pages are.
That Amazing Spider-Man looks like it's early in it's the John Byrne run. So, I mean, I don't know how good your comic shop is going to be doing if that's the thing that's on the wall, but then they redeem themselves by having, like, it looks like a page from, like, the original Incredible Hulk going on there.
Little did I know the continuity would be ruined by their inaccurate racking of comics. It's like whenever I see a comic rack in a movie or I'm always like scanning the issues to see what's on the rack.
Oh, yeah. For sure. Yeah, it always looks weird. You're like, why does that book have two covers or some kind of fake weird
names.
Thing?
The fake names are always fun.
Yeah, I miss a bunch of the plot or what the characters are doing because I spent the whole scene trying to figure out what's on the rack.
It's like people playing video games and movies, and you're like, that controller doesn't fit with that console or something weird.
So just as Marlowe was wishing Ghost Lorraine was back, Lorraine is back.
All right.
But she's human. Washes up on the beach. And I think it'll be, since the other issues arc after this goes to outer space and stuff, let's just cover Lorraine's journey right here.
Circular journey.
She's back and alive and corporeal, but because she was officially dead and buried, she's got no access to her possessions, money, bank accounts, apartment. Even her friends and family, you know, won't believe her or help her at all. She really, I mean, she can't catch a break, right? Until she meets this nice woman knitting in a diner and gets a ride. But it's Rick's crazy homicidal sort of mom from back in Incredible Hulk 398, the one who stabbed Marlo and killed her, and she kills Lorraine, stabbing her, of course. So then Lorraine's a ghost again, and she shows up at Marlo's door, like, you know, guess what? What a crazy character arc, right? Buddy. All right, then there's this whole bit with Marlo's comic shop's competing comic store that opened down the street, and it's hosting this big event, so there's all kinds of opportunities for meta inside and general industry jokes. The competing store is run by Merlin. Yeah, that Merlin. Who needs 100 virgins in one place to sacrifice for a spell. So he opened up a comic shop.
I hope he has Thunderbolts on display, though.
Kevin's back to... I want to see what's on that rack.
Exactly. Sucked right in.
I enjoyed the fights and everything. The Merlin's characterization seemed maybe overly silly, but I love...
Yeah.
He's always sliding, as Kevin said, Wonder Woman. We get an exclamation by the horns of Etrigan. Like, I love DC stuff can we slide in past the editor?
Merlin releases this giant dragon demon, the mother of Grendel, who fought Beowulf, who leads to this funny sequence of characters not knowing who Beowulf was. But the giant dragon demon adapts to something more humanoid and is kind of chatty and articulate and pretty reasonable when you get right down to it.
Yeah, Marlo's smart to play her against the wizard because, you know, demons and wizards traditionally not always best buds.
Yeah, she's uninterested in doing Merlin's bidding and leaves. And boy, is she impressed with the modern world. She's like, wow, in L.A., it doesn't take long for an agent to come along and offer to make her a star. I just thought that whole turn of events was really entertaining.
It's also nice to see the man's Chinese theater. I'm trying to remember if the Hollywood and Highland complex was up by 2001 or not. Might have been right before they put that in there. That would have been just to the east of it, kind of attaching to it.
Oh, and the bird Marlo nursed back to health becomes the armored Red Raven again and helps defeat Merlin. But wait, it was Al who works the register at the comic shop all along. And when the real Red Raven comes, he's holding comic books in front of his naughty bits. And it's a copy of Giant-Sized Man-Thing covering up his privates, which... I know you said you don't like the actual use of actual cover being...
well, you needed that in there.
That was pretty funny.
Although they could have, you know, drawn that, you know, written in Giant Size. Because now both Kevin and I are concerned how that's going to affect the grade of that book, Steve.
You think they flip every page?
Some of the posters look more drawn than some of these issues. I don't know. It varies. But yeah, some of them it looks like, I mean, it's not like 90s Photoshop, but it's still, you know.
Issues 22 to 25 have Genus getting the bright idea to ask the supreme intelligence of the Kree to help restore Rick, who's miserable, but still won't seek help for himself.
Well, but don't worry. The Kree, they'll do you a solid, right?
Yeah, and
they're always upstanding.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Genus is like, trust me, I know what I'm doing. And he takes off with the bottom of the blast of his takeoff, damaging Mount Rushmore that he was sitting on top of. Captain Marvel arrives on Hala. Hala. and doesn't recognize anyone there as Kree, except for Ronan, the accuser, who shoots him out of the sky. Pew!
Oh, I thought he might have ran into the Rawl, or is that what they? Is that how you pronounce that? You know those guys.
Or Rule, I was Rule? Thinking.
Rule, okay.
Two U's, one L, I don't know.
Yeah.
So Ronan explains the whole new Kree status quo, where the Supreme Intelligence kickstarted the Kree's plateaued evolution by wiping them out with the whole Negabomb and Operation Galactic Storm, right? And replaced them with the Rule.
In maximum security.
Check your local comic book store.
This has been another footnote.
So Genus and Ronan fight, but Genus is bested and put in a cell with none other than Unarog, who he and Marlo and Moondragon were having that whole Mora dilemma about. And fortunately, she's only been partially psychically fixed. But there's plenty of room here for them to, you know, go back and forth, and there's even some sexual tension played up. Genus is able to break them free from the cell and confront the Supreme Intelligence, who said he can help restore Rick if they retrieve this specific source of radiation from, dun-dun-dun, the negative zone.
Uh-oh.
This stuff looks good, kids. This is where you want the tablet. There's a double-page spread where they're entering the... And I'm like, I bet you this is what Kirby had in his head when he was doing those photo collages and everything.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So off they go to the negative zone. And I liked this creative team's portrayal of the Supreme Intelligence. You know, he's the big avocado head floating.
Yes.
You know, with the tentacles sticking out in stasis and everything, right? And I also really liked him remotely providing intel while they were in the negative zone, and they can see his little projection from Genus's wrist. But apparently the Supreme Intelligence could also see them back, because at one point he tells Genus to duck because he can see a blast coming from behind Genus that Genus can't see. Just funny stuff. And the whole off-panel nose pick bit was really funny too. When they are going to go to the negative zone, Unarog says, wait a minute, I thought only Reed Richards had an entrance to the negative zone. And the Supreme Intelligence is like, you know, what do you think? There's not anything that Reed Richards can do that I cannot. And Rick from the Microverse says, pick his nose. Because the Supreme Intelligence has no hands. And Genus repeats it, pick his nose. And then you just see everyone's horrified faces in the next panel, like, oh, I didn't think he could do it.
Is that like MODOK trying to scratch himself?
Exactly, with those little tiny hands, little dinosaur hands.
Now, this is the Supreme Intelligence we need a Hasbro Legend figure of, right, Kevin?
Oh, that'd be awesome. It's like a Mr. Potato Head.
How many years has it been, and they haven't even bothered to... I guess that would be an $80 figure.
Mr. Potato Head. It should be a $5 figure.
Potato not included.
It's like a soap carving tool and a couple of tentacles and eyeballs to stick on.
They don't do play sets, but I thought he would make a great kind of almost a like he's the wall part of the play set, and then little things to interact and maybe
that'd be
that
awesome.
Kind of thing. Like, so you'd go put your guys in front of him and talk to him that way.
That'd be a great Lego set.
You don't want the kids to play with him in the bathtub?
Well, I think he's in his own water, so I guess he'd be fine.
In the negative zone, Genus and Unarog encounter Blastar, the living bomb burst, of course. But also his son, Burstar.
I love the dad, not really into the kid.
Oh, I thought that's a good take.
And the kid is good because was manipulatable into turning on his dad eventually. The radiation nodes eventually required, you know, the battles are royal. The process is done with Rick, but nothing. No de-aging, no arm growing back. The Supreme Intelligence apologizes. He was certain it would work. And also, Unarag is spared from further modifications and is sent off, given a ship and sent to never be heard from again. I don't know. I guess, did Annihilation already happen? Did she survive that? We don't know.
The problem is, Steve, they didn't team her up with the recorder, so we'll never know what
happened. Yeah, exactly. And the cover of issue 24 really somehow just struck me like, this looks like a cover to Godland.
really?
The Tom Scholey and Joe Casey book, with these two hulking creatures fighting each other, floating in space. Crisscross has that Kirby power, right, in his work, where he doesn't care about the funky anatomy stuff. He doesn't care if there's the heads with no room for the brain in it, that kind of thing, because everything's so flat in the back. He's just showing, he's just, you feel the power, though. You feel the effect. You feel the environment. The storytelling isn't always clear, though. There are panels where I don't know what I'm looking at all.
I'm looking at something beautiful. That's what I'm looking at.
Yeah, I think it is. Like, for me, it's been the microverse, these alternate dimensions, the space stuff. The crazier the stuff, I think it lends to their strengths. The risk of dating the show and getting kicked off for a non-Marvel publication. I did just pick up the Kirby Collector number 90, so... They're still going strong. I just like that Kirby stuff exists in comics and people are studying him and everything.
For sure.
The king lives.
And also this chunk of issues ends with Moondragon moving in with Marlo, which is smart because she's, you know, Death just, she just had been bonded with Death for quite some time. So good idea to kind of keep an eye on her. And it's just in time for Ghost Lorraine's return to the apartment there.
I love the popcorn gag.
Writing is top notch. I think they do a good job of keeping, at least this chunk of issues, keeping things down to a small number of really well-developed characters. And I like the comedic timing. I don't think it's too overdone. But the art is solid. It's fun. It was, not always clear, but it's fun stuff. And I like that it's a consistent creative team, too. That when you get a fill-in, it makes sense. It made sense for Zerker and... Nicieza to do that fill-in that was the callback to that other series, and then to have Starlin and Milgram do the art chores on the two issues that featured Thanos, thereby legitimizing it. That also made sense for that two-parter.
Yeah, and you might only have a few characters, but I never feel like it's empty. Like some books, like they're like, oh, they had a big cast, and then they dial it back, and then you're feeling like there's something missing. Like, I know a long-running title is different than a smaller series with a smaller legacy, but still, like, there's enough going on. There's enough cool things, too.
Well, I guess I'm the turd in the punch bowl. I enjoyed them. I thought the writing from a pacing and storytelling was good, but I thought there was too much of the... Rick being a whiny guy, and some of the I would have probably dialed the humor back like 20%, because it also just removes from the stakes a lot of the time. Like the Merlin stuff, it was like some of it was kind of funny, but it was just so pointless. It felt like there was no stakes or anything involved, so I felt that I think reading these in smaller batches probably would have helped, but I actually liked all the crazy artwork and dimensions and that stuff really was appealing to me.
I think you really hit on something there. I think in a monthly way, these books seemed like a breath of fresh air to the other books in your stack.
That's right, what I was going to say. We got to send Andrew back in time, have him read these monthly, and then have him check out what's happening from Marvel from 2000 to 2001 with, like, new creators coming in like Bendis, and then Marvel heading into that James Joe Quesada era and all those books sort of taking that not necessarily always like realistic, but you know, that sort of modern style.
Decompressed, yeah.
Book. And this book gets wound up in that sort of crazy publisher's narrative too at some point.
What, you know, it's not always a bad or good thing for a comic to be in that, to have that status too, where it, you know, some books are just, they put you in a certain place and you get that out of an installment or a certain number of issues. You get that satisfaction that and that entertainment you get out of that book. But if you overdo it, like there's only so many issues of Gru, a book that I adore that I can read all in one sitting, or the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers, or even some books that are just really intense as far as having a lot of detail and stuff. You know, there's only so much, you know, what's Jeff Darrow's samurai cowboy character, that kind of, yeah. You know, some of this stuff is good to take a dip in and get that feeling and that have that interaction and get what you get out of an encounter with that type of material, and then do it again when the next chunk or piece comes out. And this book, I think, straddles that line where it's like, you know, reading an arc or two was good because I do want to know what happens, especially within each arc. But then it, when you layer them on, I kind of know what Andrew's talking about.
Well, I also forgot the assignment, so I kept reading past this point. So I read quite a good chunk, but I think you're definitely right. And also, they're so good. There's none of this. I didn't have to go back. It ain't like you say, all the plots you can pick up no matter how long it's been or anything. There wasn't any sort of like, wait, who are these people or whatever. It was well, you're kind of instantly back in whatever scene. So all that was really well done. So I think, yeah, the monthly blast on this would have been great.
And the Micronauts. I mean, yeah. They had the Micronauts.
Yeah, even though you've read a little bit ahead, and we'll keep reading, but there's definitely going to be some comparisons, because we'll go to some different places, and then you'll look back either fondly, or you'll be like, the more, not current stuff, but closer to modern day, you'll be like, oh, that stuff was way better. Like you'll definitely have some thoughts.
Oh, I'm sure. And like I said, some of it was also just this slice of time. They made Rick really pretty insufferable, and some of that's on me. I was never a huge Rick Jones guy at any point in time, so
we noticed.
Yeah. I mean, hey, I love CB radio as much as the next guy, or ham radio, whatever the hell the Teen Brigade used. But I felt it was a weird artifact to keep going when it was kind of something that Marvel was notoriously not a fan of at any point. You know what I mean? They weren't the kid sidekick thing.
Yeah, he should have been jumping on the BBSs and talking about early internet lingo and everything.
Exactly. That would have been. I would love if every generation they now he's like a TikTok guy or whatever. Yeah,
exactly. Oh, God.
Don't worry, right. I got help. I blasted out a TikTok, so all the kids will meet us there.
We're gonna do a flash mob at the store.
All right, the last 10 issues of this series will be upcoming at some point. That would be our third of five segments covering all of Peter David's handling of these characters in the two Captain Marvel series as he had. But next episode is a recent round. But next episode is a recent reads roundtable. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Andrew, as always. Until the Supreme Intelligence joins Diana Ross on tour, make mine marble. Later. Mine.